Hello and welcome to Intertextual Experience, where we're going to find out the decision space behind why our 40th guest, Pete Wissinger, has agreed to this madness and maybe the madness of other spaces too. How are you doing today, Pete?
I'm doing good. It's Sunday morning. I've got my Earl Grey tea. I'm excited to be recording with you.
That is awesome. Well, I don't want to get too ahead of ourselves, but I'm curious. You have a nice tea. I switch from coffee to water right now, but there
I
might be
already
a
had coffee.
okay. Okay, good. Perfect. There might be a question on about coffee on here because, well, we were just chatting for a minute before we started, but this is a couple of things. This is a well, obviously talking to you about the things that you're doing. The intro mentioned a decision space. So you've been a part of that podcast for a bit now. You're designing and developing and it's like working in the board game space, but also as a teacher, and that is a connection that we have. And we actually also met at Gen Con. So we were talking a little bit there. And we're kind of just chatting about how, you can do the conventions over the summer, so that's nice for the sake of board games there. But obviously, ones happen during the school year, and that makes it trickier too. But you've been going for a while, and this is still going to be like a back to school special. But you've just wrapped up a full month of teaching.
That is true. Yeah. So I am a high school social studies teacher, and this is my 18th year teaching. So, yeah, I am a veteran at this point. Yeah. It's kind of
Dang.
wild to think that I've been doing that job for that long, right? That I'm like almost not quite, but I'm closer. I'm in the middle of my career, I guess. I'm not quite over the edge to where I'm saying I'm in the latter half of my career, but yeah.
Yeah, well, first off, I mean, congratulations. Yeah, almost 20 years is wild. Bam, I haven't. I mean, I technically have been full-time-ish teaching because I took a little pause as in a half a year since like 2017. So that is not 18 years. But I was in education a little bit before then too. So I guess everything has always pushed me back to education. It's like Lost. No matter where I want to go, I have to be at school.
Did you like school as a student?
Yeah. I think high school for me, and that's where I teach too. Like I enjoyed being in high school on the whole. I would say I was like a good student, right? Like
Sure.
I was not. I probably didn't tap into my full potential in high
This
school.
isn't an interrogation. I'm not
No.
trying to get you.
Oh, no. I was yeah. High school was fun. I really liked high school, but then I think, post-secondary, college, and finding more interest in theater, creative writing, and all things English, it just kind of opened up my brain. It's like, wow, learning is so cool. And I became obsessed. Like I
Yeah.
really, really loved school and college.
Yeah, for sure. I also enjoyed college more than high school. Absolutely.
Yes. But yeah, so we're doing a back to school special. I've got a lot. Well, here I'll share with you the hook in a second, but I just did want to say too that yeah, it's been 4 weeks for you, 2 weeks for me, but we met at Gen Con, and one of the people who was like, we walked, like I walked, I was with my buddy Eric, who's been on the show, and we were kind of doing Gen Con together, but we walked basically everywhere. It was like a decent hike, but one day it was raining, and our Uber driver, because we just didn't want to get like soaked on the way to the convention, was like, oh, I've got to, hop back and get my kids to school. It's their first day of school, and it was in July.
Whoa.
So I looked it up, and yeah, the whole state of Indiana was kind of that week. It was like either Tuesday of that week or Friday. So they
That's terrible.
Yeah.
I've thought my coworkers and I have discussed like how much more would they have to pay you to work over the summer? And it's like double, I think. It's yeah, you can't stress how big of a perk a summer break is You know, other jobs don't have this. Other jobs aren't like, and then we did all the work and we took 2 months off and then we started all over again. They just, their jobs just go, right? Mm-hmm. There's something so special about, you know, doing a job for a set amount of time, finishing your work, like you're done, mm-hmm. being totally clear from that, right? And then you start totally fresh. And it, there's just like, I don't know, I'm sure we'll talk about it, but there's so many perks for my brain in terms of how teaching works as a career.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, July would kind of ruin that.
Oh my gosh. Hopefully they're off May 1st or something. I don't know.
it's a funky schedule. Like, yeah, they have like fall break, winter breaks, spring break, and they're all like 10-ish, 11-ish days.
Oh yeah.
And all that. And then, yeah.
No, our fall break is just like a 3-day weekend. Yep. Yeah.
Oh, but yeah, so I saw that and yeah, craziness. I used to teach summer school. I did summer school for a bit too. So I guess I did work over the summer.
Had you been to Gen Con before?
That was my first Gen Con.
Yeah. It was my second. No. Third, I think. I've only gone in the past to like work a booth. Actually, that's still true. I've only ever gone to large conventions working for booths because I am cheap and don't want to pay to go. So I will work to earn my keep at a convention.
That's fair. Maybe I'll look into that in the future, but I don't know. It was nice. It was very, I think like not doing that did give some flexibility. Like I could just do whatever I wanted.
Oh, I'm jealous. Yeah. It sounds great.
But yeah, no, it worked out well. I was glad I did it. Glad I went. So first time, second con ever as well.
Okay. Yeah. What other convention had you gone to?
The only other one I went to was PAX Unplugged the fall winter before.
I really want to go to PAX Unplugged. So I live in St. Louis, and so Origins and Gen Con are both a drivable distance for me. Mm-hmm. So, and they're both also over the summer. So going in the winter to Philadelphia sounds awesome, but I'd have to take off work, you know?
Yep.
But yeah, then we also have a local convention in St. Louis called Geek Way to the West that I go to, which is a totally different speed. It's the vendor hall is like 20 booths. It's really just ballrooms full of people playing games, which is honestly probably more fun.
Yep. Yeah, that's like, I mean, honestly, I liked kind of navigating the vendor hall in, you know, bits and pieces, but no more than like 40 minutes a day. just for the sake of like seeing stuff, seeing people, chatting a little bit,
yeah,
then getting out.
If you're one of those people who's there to spend $1,000 on games that weekend, then it's probably great, but they're teachers.
Yes, exactly. That's why I spent most of my time at the consignment shop.
There you go. All right.
Oh, that's funny. Perfect. Well, okay. This is kind of a mix up of several types of things I've done before, but the newness of this is that I've created, hopefully, yeah, there's probably issues on here, but usually I kind of like do some random format and have questions and have follow-up questions or whatever. And like the guest is subjected to like the random cast that I provide as we go. But for you, you're going to receive a document, and you can like pick and choose how you want to answer these questions.
Okay.
Unsurprisingly, there's probably way more questions here. You could probably take a question and then talk about it for like an entire episode. I mean, that's kind of like, we're teachers. I over prepare. Like,
you gotta over prepare. Oh my gosh! Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. So my over preparing always just goes super crazy. But I will share this document with you, and it's here. I'll click.
Is this coming in the chat?
Yeah, I'm gonna throw this into our chat. Okay.
Okay. Cool.
So it's in the chat. I'll just read the title of the document, and then anything else, like the way you work through reading it is up to you, and I will not interrupt. But it, says the legally distinct unofficial play CT. So
All
we've gone back to school and we're standardized testing like right away.
right.
But
All right, cool.
yeah, we've got
Okay.
some sections that resemble sections that you might see
Oh
on
my gosh, you've given me a test.
giving you a test.
Beautiful.
But you can like go anywhere. So unlike the ACT where you're doing like one section, one section, one section, this is bare,
All right.
all
So
open.
here's what I'll talk about myself as a student, in that when I take a test, I never go out of order or go back to a question. I am someone who, when
Oh.
I take a test, I read it, I do my best to answer it right there, and that is it, right? Like, I know I don't typically mark things to come back to. Like, I'm like, I just keep going. I was that annoying student who, when I was in high school, I would be like the first person to turn in a test, because I, in general, am not someone who overthinks it on a test, which is so funny because in my life I overthink all the time, but on a test, I'm just like boom, boom, boom. So I will probably take these in order because that is generally how I take tests.
Okay. So I guess the only response, I mean, do you take them in order? So I'll give you like a couple of like thoughts. If you want me to like kind of read the things, then I can.
Sure.
I think an order like allows things to go well. If yeah, and timing wise, if there's things that you want to like, I don't know, skip over or combine or whatever. It's like in this first one. Okay, so I actually did put the things in order of way the sections would kind of look on the ACT. So we have English, and it says just introductory questions with grammatical mistakes. As this isn't actually the ACT, you do not have to answer English first. Don't feel obliged to start here, but we are.
Well, what the English is the first section, right? I've proctored many an ACT.
Oh, it's a great time,
It's
isn't
a great way to make
it?
$100 on a Saturday morning. Yeah.
Well, I don't proctor like we do you, is it a part of Missouri where you do like everyone's doing it?
Yeah. So,
Okay.
okay, at my old school, I used to do it for extra cash on the weekends. But at my current school, there's one day that the school offers it. It's like the juniors take the ACT, the sophomores take the PSAT, the freshmen take something else, and the seniors like go to an amusement park.
That's good.
And I am one of the more responsible teachers, not to toot my own horn, which means I'm always given the ACT to proctor. I
Oh,
never go to
yeah.
the amusement park. That's like, if you're a teacher who gets called to the amusement park, it kind of means that like the school doesn't trust you to proctor a test.
That's A fair, B funny, and yeah, we all kind of have to where I'm at, and I guess it shifts by like what resource cohort you're with or whatever, but I feel like I've done even more than that, if that makes sense. But
All right,
all right,
let's
so English
jump to it.
first. You kind of actually answered these questions, not the last one.
Yeah, I'll talk. So the question here is, how long have you been teaching? The answer is 18 years. I taught for 9 years at a private all-girls Catholic school, and then for the past 9 years, I've been at a public suburban high school. What do I teach? I'm a social studies teacher. Funny enough, I have a master's degree in medieval and Renaissance history, but I teach AP US government and economics. So I'm really putting that master. I mean, I've taught just about every class that encompasses social studies, which is, I don't know, at least six totally distinct subject areas that all get lumped into social studies. The one thing I haven't taught is psychology. But and do I like it? Yeah, for sure. I really like teaching in general. I really like teaching AP government, which is becoming more and more like one of the most depressing things you can teach. Not to go on and on about that, but I'm teaching like juniors. I think juniors are a pretty fun group to teach because seniors have the least amount of motivation because they're just thinking about being done. Freshmen are basically middle schoolers, and then sophomores tend to have the worst attitude. And so I find junior, there's something that happens between sophomore and junior year when you're in high school where you all of a sudden become like self-aware. Like you're like, oh, I shouldn't just be annoying. all the time. There's something about the juniors who are like starting to take things more seriously, but they still care. So yeah, I teach AP government and I do like it a lot. I get to have a lot of interesting discussions with my students. Yeah, for sure.
Good. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that's like a trick question.
Oh man, what if I'd said I hate it? That would have ruined this whole episode. I also generally enjoy talking to teenagers. Like, I think you have to enjoy hanging out with teenagers to be a teacher, because if you're saying I'm teaching because I love my subject matter, that can only take you so far and maybe is a path towards frustration, because you don't, you know, you teach who shows up in the room. They might not be interested in the subject matter. You might not be able to get as in depth as you want. So I think you really have to enjoy interacting with teenagers almost as much as you need to care about what you're teaching.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, yeah, I think even no matter what, you're going to run into those frustrations when you do. I mean, obviously you're going to care more about the subject matter than most all of the people you're engaging with. But when the disconnect, that chasm is too big, it's just like, oh, like I'm trying to work out something that's like actually relatively fun. Like, we're talking about a good book compared to, you know, grammar or something. It's like, throw me a bone.
Yeah. Yeah. When I'm teaching about, you know, bureaucratic regulations, I've got to pretend like it's the most interesting thing in the world. I always joke to my students that, like, there's a lot, and you're maybe an interest in theater. There's a lot of theater in teaching. There's a lot of acting in teaching, because you have to like give a performance, whether you're feeling it or not. And I always say it's kind of like stand-up comedy, because I teach multiple sections of the same class. And so a stand-up comedian is given the same set night after night after night, and they have to like sell the joke every time. They have to know where the laugh line is. They also have to adapt to the audience if it's not super working. And so I think that teaching, I always tell the students, you'll never know if I'm having a bad day, because like my job is to come in and act like there's nothing else I'd rather be doing right now than teaching you this subject right now.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I 100% agree. I think when thinking about like some of the theater that I've done, which was very brief and was very like focused in the post-secondary bit, like initial chunk of post-secondary bit, it's like, yeah, I'm not like going out and doing a ton of theater or anything on my own, but it's like, yeah, I get to do this all the time. Like, I have to do this all the time.
Yeah. I think about people in the business world who like prepare for weeks to give like one presentation. And I'm like, I'm giving four presentations a day, right? Like, you know, that's what it is. Yeah.
Yep. Oh, okay. So we do like it, which is good. Okay. We don't have to like just abandon this the test, because it's like, yeah, we actually no.
Actually, this sucks. I'd love a different job if someone's got something better for me.
Awesome. Okay, so kind of the English is meant to be introductory. At what points and perhaps how have your teaching and gaming intersected? Could be something like, oh, this was just mistyped. You were in a like Catan gaming group college, or something. Sure. That you're doing today, whatever, just any intersections.
So I can think of two main things. Okay. The first thing is that the obvious thing is that I have used board games in my classes before. So in my economics class, my students play Catan and we play QE. And we I've also played modern art with them. And because economics is one of those subjects that economic decision making is baked into games. And so I teach them Catan, which is not that hard to teach, right? Teenagers can figure it out. And we use that to talk about things like incentives and mutually beneficial trade and different values of things, scarcity, surplus, all this kind of stuff. So I have them play, I teach them Catan, then they play it for a day after teaching it. And then I give them the assignment of like, hey, try and think of how all of these vocab words that and theories and principles we've been using apply. Then I have them play it again. And then we have, you know, the boring thing, which is to write like an essay on it, basically. And then QE, which I don't know if you've played QE. It's an auction game that Allplay puts out.
I own it. I've read the rules at least twice, and the general premise is you can bid like whatever, but you don't want to be the person who bids the most by the
Correct.
end.
You literally have blank checks. You play governments. QE stands for quantitative easing. Your government's buying public businesses, and or they're going to be public. But anyway, you want to get the most points in the auctions, but if you spent the most money, then you accidentally devalued your currency and your country's economy collapses. So I use that game to talk about inflation because since there's no scarcity, right? And also we look at the values people paid for victory points at the start of the game compared to the values people paid for victory points later in the game. And inflation just naturally happens throughout the game and sort of about how money supply is connected to inflation. And then I've used modern art sort of to teach kind of like stock speculation. Modern art is a auction game from Reiner Knizia. And in that game, you're buying art. And then every round you sell your art, and the art is valuable based on how many paintings by that artist were bought. And so every time you're buying art, you're essentially increasing the value of that artist. And so really, I think it's like it's basically a stock game, right? But if not enough people ended up buying art from that artist, then you've lost money, right? It's going to be worth nothing. And so I've used modern art as well. So that's the first connection is that I literally have used board games in my economics class. I also have done quasi-social deduction games when I taught history before. Like when I taught about the Red Scare, I made up a game where basically I gave them all an index card that either had a blue dot or a red dot on it. And then I told them the goal was to figure out who has a red dot on their index card. And I told them that there were five people who had red dots, but there were actually only two. And so the game was that they had to figure out who had a red dot, but that if they accused any blue dot person and convicted them, that was points for the red team. And so it, of course, creates the like Red Scare paranoia sort of thing. And so that was a fun game that I made up. And what's funny is that they're like, oh, well, let's play again. I'm like, you guys, this was designed for you to fail. Like, you can't win this game. But then the other way that my profession intersects is that in order to really be engaged in the board game hobby, you have to like teaching and learning. Unless you're getting together to play the same game every night, which most board gamers do not. You are probably a couple times a month either teaching a group a game or learning a game from somebody teaching. And I, not to toot my own horn, am very good at teaching games. And so I, for my group, I go to like three different game groups. One of them I host. And the group that I host, I'm mostly the one who has the game collection. I'm the one who buys games, learns them, and teaches them to the group. And there is such a barrier in teaching and learning games, right? I don't remember who was that said it, but there was someone who said that like every rule in a game is a barrier preventing someone from learning the game, right? And so understanding the best way to kind of like organize the rules, what order to tell them in, what to focus on, whether a game needs a full teach up front or whether you can kind of teach as you go. Like teaching is a huge part of fully engaging in the board game hobby. And so I think my teaching skills have actually made that really useful. And that's also true of like demoing games at conventions where I'm essentially teaching people in a crowded room how to play a game as quickly as possible to get them to the fun. Or in designing games, running play tests, figuring out whether your rules are intuitive or not, whether people, you know, it's the kind of formative assessments of teaching is also part of teaching a game, and especially the iteration process of designing games, where you need to say, okay, are these rules clear or not? Are people learning them? Are they understanding the strategy? And that's teaching skills as well.
Okay, so I do have a little, yeah, like based on that second one, I kind of have like a hair of a follow-up, but then also based on your first part of that response, I'm going to go down and I'm going to like as a proctor force you to answer a different question
Okay,
later
great.
on in
That's
the
fine.
test. Yeah.
Wow. I've never done this for a kid on the ACT, but I won't report you to College Board.
Yeah, don't tell me that I'm opening up like a different section and closing it off. Ooh, okay, good. But no, based on that second one, I think I'm in like a relatively similar boat. When I teach games, I don't know how good I am. I think I'm like in that okay to good range. Like that's kind of how I would describe my ability to teach games. I think I'm in the different groups that I'm a part of, I'm probably going to be the person who does it the most as well. So very, very similarly. I think the thing that I kind of struggle with and kind of want to work towards is yeah, like I want to see what I can do to kind of like think about the ordering, pare it down to like the basics, and then decide like how we're going to go from there. Is it, you know, more of a rolling thing, or does it all need to be up front? But I think much like teaching in general, where you have a classroom of 20, 30 students and just trying to not like accommodate, but trying to think of different learning styles. I think in the classroom, it's weird. Even though there's more people, I think you can almost get to different ways to get to the objective a little bit quicker. Whereas, like, if somebody learns a board game a little bit differently, I feel like the steps to that can be a little funkier if people aren't learning in the same way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, some people really need to know every rule up front because they are gamers who want to win, and they want to, their goal in any game is to win, which of course is like obviously there's all kinds of philosophy about that being the point of a game or whatever. But for some players, they're willing to teach that first game as a learning game. And their goal is not to win, but to like learn and understand. And teaching games to those two types of gamers is very different. I tend not to feel the need to teach every rule up front. That's generally, I like to, well, it kind of depends. Sometimes you need to give people the theme, sometimes that doesn't really matter. And if you have people who learn in different ways at different styles at the game table, let's say you're playing a game with four or five people and everyone's kind of cool with how you're doing, but one person is just kind of like, wait, wait, wait. And you just kind of have to roll with it. I mean, that is also part of teaching is differentiated instruction, right? And so some people maybe need a little bit more hand holding. Some people don't want the hand holding. I tend to play games with people who are friends. I don't go to meetups where with strangers. I go to game groups of people who know each other. So I think I'm dealing with that issue a little bit less because the interpersonal relationships are preset. But yeah, another thing is for some people, they're okay with you kind of giving them strategic pointers for their first couple of turns, but other people really don't want you to tell them what to do. And so you just kind of have to, in that situation, give people what they want, you know? I mean, you can't totally make everyone happy, but there is this weird pressure when you're teaching a game, especially if it's a game that you like and would like to continue playing, that you're like, this needs to go well, or this might be the last time I play this game, right? So that is a delicate kind of situation because people have a bad first experience with a game, often don't want to play it a second time. And a bad teach can really give that bad first experience.
One thing that I was literally just kind of like looking, because this room is a nightmare, but one thing I bought, because I saw it on, I don't really go look on Reddit for the board game stuff like a ton occasionally, like whatever, just poke around. But I did see maybe a year ago, I couldn't even tell you what it was at this point, somebody had like posted these very elaborate kind of like rules references on a whiteboard. And I thought that was actually like pretty cool. So it was kind of like, you know, like a quick reference for the basic actions or symbols and stuff. And they like, you know, made it really nice. I'm like, huh, that's actually pretty neat. So you could kind of go through stuff and have it. So I actually have a whiteboard because I wanted to use it for that, and also just like other game design stuff, like this massive whiteboard. And I haven't used it, so that's I
That's
guess I'm
cool.
surprised. Yeah.
I mean, that is another thing where it is so important for game publishers to make their games easy to learn, no matter how complicated the game is. You know, good player aids can go such a long way. We've all tried to learn games from poorly written rule books. You know, I think you and I are both maybe interested in historical war games, and historical war games are great for creating rules reference documents and pretty terrible for making game learning and teaching documents. And that's such a barrier to learning these games that maybe are actually not all that complicated, but the rules are just not, they're written as reference materials, not as teaching tools.
Yeah, and I think I was listening to one of Liz Davidson's Beyond Solitaire podcast, and there was like a lot of talk about how that's has been shifting a bit in the historical spaces too, and you know there are like more and more publishers like making games in those spaces, and it's kind of like almost challenging each other to the point where yeah, it's like what can be done to.
Yeah. Well, I'll say I helped play test the rule book for a game that's coming out called Stellar Ventures. It's coming out from a publisher called Tabletop Us, and it is essentially a what gamers would call a train game. It's kind of somewhere between a cube rails game and an 18xx game. And I would say outside of historical wargaming, 18xx might be the other most intimidating corner of the hobby to explore. And this is like a sci-fi shared incentive stock train kind of game. But they wrote that rule book so that I, who have never played an 18xx game, could easily learn and teach the game from the rule book, which is so impressive. And I think it's really important for, and that was my goal. My job was to try and learn the game from the rule book, and we were successful. So that's huge. And on the flip side, I've tried to get into the Levy and Campaign series from GMT, which is these like two-player medieval operational war games. I have bought two of those titles, tried to learn them from the rule book, and failed. And so it's just like, I think that the historical war game hobby has so many people who are so familiar, like they know their target audience, people who are already familiar with this style of game. And for an outsider trying to get in, it can feel a little unwelcoming. So shout out to Tabletop Us for saying, hey, here's a style of game that's intimidating and we're making it approachable.
That's good. Yeah, Stellar Ventures looks great. I think I saw if I'm not mistaken, you posted about it recently
I did on Blue
as well.
Sky,
Awesome. So I did see that one. And I too own two of the Levy and Campaign games and have read rules, watched videos, and
And the only
I'm
rules videos that exist are like 2 hours long. And it's like, oh, it can't be this complicated.
I'll crack that one open again soon and see what I can do with it. That's funny. Okay, so yeah, now moving forward, yet backtracking, you said one of your connections was the games in the classroom, and you mentioned Catan, QE, and modern art. So if we hop down to science, it says which the question, I mean, you kind of answered. I think you said Catan was the most. Which game have you experimented science with the most in your classroom? So I guess like just double checking that Catan is the game that has entered your classroom most as a part A to the follow-up, and then part B with these games, oftentimes limited player count might be smaller than like your class size. So is it a case of multiple copies? Do you have teams and or like students and groups or teams, or kind of like how do you, I guess, tinker for the sake of the classroom?
So I have class sets of Catan and QE that were bought with department funds.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. So yes, you are not playing on a team. You are your own player. And I just want to say, playing Catan with teenagers sort of reinvigorated why I loved it back when I was starting board gaming in college. Like, I think a lot of hardcore board gamers are like, would turn their nose up at the idea of playing Catan in 2025. But it's still got the magic, right? I think that open trading is so rare in like a Euro game now. But it's so funny because so many people's intro to Euro games is Catan, which has that like interactive social experience baked into it.
Yeah, no, I think there's definitely have been lists or videos or things to think about. It's like, okay, if you want to try to get like similar feelings from Catan, here are other games type of thing. But yeah, it still has, like you said, that secret sauce, that magic blend that I think especially does hit for people getting into the hobby. It just makes it extremely interactive and like a raucous time where you can enjoy your company.
Yeah, now I will say, I wish that for my government class, I had the time to play more games and the resources to buy some historical games. Like, I really like there's a game called 1960 Making of a President, which is kind of like almost like a sequel game to Twilight Struggle. It's got the same card-driven system. It's designed by Jason Matthews, who was one of the designers on Twilight Struggle. It's about the 1960 presidential election, and it is so awesome. And I wish I could buy 13 copies of it or whatever I would need. But it's the big limitation factor to playing games in classrooms is, first of all, that one takes a long time to learn and it takes a long time to play. You know, I've got a 90-minute class period, so I need to be able to have them set it up, play it, and clean it up in 90 minutes, which limits you in terms of a lot of hobby board games.
Yeah, I think I mean there obviously could be ways to like try to make workarounds and stuff, but then it becomes to a point it's like how I
I could
don't
design my own adaptation, right? I could
Yeah.
design a game, you know,
But
but my game
even
design time is not necessarily being used to make heavy games for my classroom, you know.
exactly. And then it's just a matter of two, it's like, well, if I mean, yeah, you can't leave it out for the next hour. You can't just like, oh, hey, set up. We'll reconvene tomorrow. It's like, nope, got a new class coming in like 5 minutes. So,
All right.
all
So, do we
right,
go back to English?
we go back. Okay,
Okay.
so I'll read the English one. And unfortunately, moving forward, the quick math section has actually quicker questions too.
Great.
All right, so we're still in English, but it says you wrote number 3 of 3, an absolute banger of Designer Diary for Crits and Tricks based
Oh,
on that.
thank you.
Yeah, of course, I really like that. I love reading Designer Diaries in general,
I
so
do too. Yeah.
so that's kind of what this question is about. So kind of like based on that process, reading other Designer Diaries and everything like that, how would you kind of categorize different types of Designer Diaries you've seen? And then also, what did the process of designing and writing a reflection on it provide?
Yeah, so I do love, you know, one of the coolest things that Board Game Geek does is on their front page, they will often feature design diaries from designers, which is a really cool thing to put on the front page of the website. And I read a decent amount of them. You know, you and I are both big Cole Whirley fans. He writes extensive design diaries, which are really cool. I think that some of the design diaries that I read are just sort of like, here, it's basically just like an extended explanation of the game's rules, right? But what I want in a designer diary is I want to hear about the iteration. I want to hear about what you tried and why it didn't work. Or the other thing I like to hear about is the conceptualization. You know, I think a lot of design diaries skip past those things, which I think are the most interesting parts of design, is kind of what was the original idea? And then what did you try that didn't work? And so those are the kinds of ones that I am more interested in. And so some of those design diaries are really good at that. I think that, you know, Cole Whirley's is so much about kind of like the metaphors that the game is working in and how the mechanisms represent those metaphors, which is like a level that I'm not quite able to do for my, I haven't, you know, design very much, obviously. But yeah, I tend to want ones to, I also like when a design diary, you get to kind of know the personality of the designer a little bit. You know, I don't, what I don't want is a design diary for me to be reading it to sound like homework. You know, I don't want it to sound like someone's just like, or like a sales pitch. You know, I typically am interested in a designer diary to tell me like the process, because as a game designer, you get inspired by reading about other people's design process.
Yeah, I think yeah, definitely for me, it's always, I don't know, I'm like to a fault at different times, like probably very like story centric. So it's just like, yeah, where did this design idea come from? Like, what was going on in the designer's life? Like, what inspired them and everything like that? Like, and then just having these really kind of like, you know, like the unique happenstances that make a game happen in the first place, and just like being able to read about those. That's what I like a lot. So.
Yeah, and so Crits and Tricks is a game I have that was on crowdfunding this year that's coming out next year. It's a trick-taking game that uses polyhedral dice. My designer diary for that was a lot about the failures along the way, because it's, I guess it's hard not to focus on that kind of thing as someone who just like looks back on a process. But what I tried to sort of get out in that is like how the failures that I had in that process actually made the game better. Like one of the biggest moments in that game's development is that I think I pitched it before it was ready, right? And I had some a really bad pitch that like shattered my confidence in the game. But had I not had that terrible pitch, the game would not have gotten better. And so that's like experiencing failure with a design is a necessary component to a design becoming what it should be, right?
Yeah. And in that diary too, because I literally just closed out of it, and I don't know why, because I was like looking at it again. And it also was just kind of, you know, like a bit of a like a love letter to like a couple of the things that you were passionate about in Trick Takers
Yeah.
and Dungeons Dragons
For
RPG as
sure.
well. So
Yeah.
yeah, no, I agree with that. I mean, I think, you know, wherever that like learning point comes, or wherever that, you know, quote unquote failure might pop up to, is going to be very influential in the next steps in that revision. And now, like, yeah, and then just through those circumstances, you made
Yeah.
like an awesome game, which was part of like
Thanks.
a successfully funded crowdfunding
Yes, I'm
effort.
excited for people to actually get it. It's so
Yes.
funny, like the way that crowdfunding works, where it's like, I designed the game, they signed it, we worked on it together for like a year, then people can order it, and then like a year later, people will play it. So it's just like the time gap is pretty wild.
That'll be good. Maybe we can definitely, I mean, I'll probably talk to you in general, but I'm excited for that time to come too. Speaking of time, we will go to math, and this
Oof.
would
My,
well,
not
yeah.
my favorite section on the ACT, I gotta say.
That's fair. Not me either. A couple of these questions actually have like links below, but you can we don't have to, especially for the first two, you don't have to justify, you don't have to do anything. You can just throw out numbers
Great.
for the sake of throwing out numbers. So quick math. What percentage of teachers are gamers?
Well, I'm going to assume that by gamers, we just mean people who enjoy games. I'm not going to gatekeep gamer.
Yes,
And I would
100%.
say probably 75 to 80%. I think that there is something inherently attractive about games to teachers. I think that includes sports, it includes whatever. I think that there's something about games that. Yeah, I would say so. I would say probably 75, 80%.
I like that number too. I like the qualification. Yeah, I in regards to gamers, I kind of meant the same thing. Like, yeah, it doesn't.
Great.
All right, on the inverse, what percentage of gamers are teachers?
Most, I would put that at probably 90%. Like I said, being a gamer means that you are teaching people how to play games. Yeah.
So we're not gonna gatekeep gaming, and we're also gonna not gonna keep teaching.
No.
Everybody or
No.
90% of people can be teachers. All right, quick math number three: discrepancy between your BGG collection stats total and how many games you actually
I update that pretty regularly. So there's
have.
maybe like a 10 game gap. I'm not always good at marking it as previously owned when I get rid of it. And usually it's not until I've like, because here's one thing about me and how I use BGG is one way that I track what games I've played is I give every game I've played a BGG score just as a way for me to know how many games I've played and what my general impression. I don't write a review, I just give it a star rating. And so every game I have played, I've given a star rating on BGG. But that is not because I see myself as a critic or because I think people should care. It's purely for me to track what games I've played and my general impression of it looking back. Okay, I played that game 4 years ago. Oh, I gave it a six. I must not have liked it very much, right?
Okay, so I have like a follow-up question. So I know that I'm very similar. Okay, I'm kind of similar. I don't rate every game that I play. I just log the plays. That's the way that I see if I've played it or not. And I do rate some games. The reasons I do it is like if I feel like a game, like I like it and I want to give it a rating, that's a generally favorable rating relative to its kind of like existing score or whatever like that. But I also find myself not really using the rating system similar to the way that the criteria breakdown of BGG has it either. I feel like I've kind of always rated, and again, I'm not a critic, nor do I really want to be, in that, like, giving game scores or reviewing them or whatever. I just like talking about them. I still rate them on kind of like a teacher scale, and like so that like 60 to 100 range to me is where most things are going to fall. So
Yeah,
it's
I've rated 672 games on Board Game Geek. And I have given less than 30 games a score below a six.
okay.
So my average is a 7.34. So my average is like a C,
Yeah.
which is I'm a much that's a harder grader than I am in my classroom.
Okay, yeah. I think, yeah, mine I've only rated 48. My average rating is 8.49, but like I said, I tend to rate games that I like. I don't.
Now, according to BGG, I have 214 games in my collection and I've gotten rid of 32. So that's probably off. I probably own, and it's embarrassing. I think that this is too many games. I'm actually ashamed to own the number of board games that I own. But a lot of them are small box games. So, whatever. But I would say I'm probably closer to 250 and I've gotten rid of at least 50 games. So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think yeah, I just for the sake of many things, I won't I'm not much more than that, but it's probably a little bit more.
The shameful consumerism.
But yes, I have slowed down and I have sold more or given away or whatever, literally just like gifts,
Yeah.
enjoy this game, please. Okay, so finally, the final question on the quick math section is I have more of an unwritten preface for it. So you kind of actually like m mentioned some of the things that I was going to preface this question for, but you can raise your hand and ask for some teacher guidance on this part. But ultimately, you're going to create labels for the balls. There's okay for people who cannot see this,
Yeah,
maybe
I've
I'll.
got six balls here, and I'm supposed to balance them. And I'm assuming this is representing some sort of work-life balance.
For kind of like how the things fit when you're both in school and out of school.
Yeah.
So there's a seesaw, and I've been making kind of games mentioned in this episode documents to make the show notes more whatever, or just add more to the show notes without like I'll put this image in there so people can see. It's
Yeah.
like, okay, this is what it
I'm
is.
ready for this. I already think I so only two of these balls are going to relate to my teaching profession.
Okay.
And that's and so we'll start from the left. Okay, so the dark blue ball is going to be actually like my job of teaching. Okay. And then the green ball I'll say is kind of like the homework of teaching, like prep and grading and all of that. So I would say out of my life of six categories, two of them I would say relate to my profession. All right. The next ball over is going to be another type of work, the purple. And that is going to be that I help my wife with her business. My wife is an entrepreneur. So my wife owns a bakery and a gourmet popsicle business here in St. Louis. And so I help her a lot on the weekends. I help work her booth at the local farmers market every Saturday morning. And I'm often helping her make things at the shop. So I suppose that's another type of like work. So there's my three work categories. And then the other three, I'm going to put the red one is just going to be general non-game related socializing. That's probably going to include friends and family time. And then the orange is going to be gaming related socializing. So I host a game night every week, and I go to one or two other game nights every week. And then the last one will be game design related things, which includes actually working on my designs and also play testing my designs and other people's designs. So I would say those would be the six balls. So I guess we could put the three work ones, two of them being my work, one of them being my wife's work on one side. And then the other side is the other elements. And I'm honestly embarrassed that two out of the six balls of my life's energy and time are related to gaming. I often feel like too much of my personal time is spent on games, be it designing and playing. I'm self-conscious about the fact that, I don't have kids, so I do have more time than a lot of my peers. But sometimes my life feels out of balance in that two out of the six balls of my life should not be related to games. But that's what it is, if I'm being honest.
That's, you know what, I don't see like a ton of issue. I think like I'm all about the idea of balance, since there's a question about balance here. And I mean, I know that there are like certain, I let other balls like fall because I'm like not balancing them. Like I'm super interested in all things English literature, and my reading has just been, usually each summer I can kind of get back into the groove of reading a little bit. My reading sucked the summer. Yeah, I don't know. So that was a ball that I dropped.
I fit reading in. There's actually, I probably need another ball, but it's fine. I fit reading in when I'm like driving to work because I have a 30-minute commute, and when I'm like walking my dogs. So audiobooks have been like huge for me. I used to be really into movies. I maybe am watching a movie like once a month now, which is crazy. I play too many video games. It's kind of funny how video games to me in terms of my gaming feels like junk food. Like I don't get that same feeling when I'm playing a board game, but when I'm playing a video game, for whatever reason, I'm sometimes like I could be doing something else, and that's just sort of like maybe something I need to work on. But it's something I feel like I should limit my time doing, even though it's a totally valid way to spend my hobby time. So yeah,
Oh yeah, I
it feels
mean,
at odds with my game design is what it is. It's like every time I'm like spending hours playing a video game at night, I'm like, I could have been working on a game. But that's
yeah.
maybe the capitalist, in me being like, all my time should be spent productively and not on leisure. So
I just worked for 8 to 10 hours today. I need to keep working.
yeah. It's tough.
Yeah, I get that. But I think I do like video games, and I think from a board game standpoint, well, this whole another topic, can It's just a it's a nice, depending on what the type of game is, it has narrative elements, it has like mechanical elements, has all these different things that can get you thinking about board games too. And it's just like
Oh
a
yeah.
nice, it's just a nice reset. You need it. You need it. Don't feel
Yeah.
bad about your video game ball.
For sure. Video games 100% inspire my board game design thinking. 100%. Yeah.
Awesome. All
All right, so
right.
we're out of math. I did it. I made it through the math
You made it through
section.
math. Let's say out of 36, you got a 30 out of 36. You were
That
you
was my actual ACT score.
look at that. Wow. Who knew my clairvoyant skills
Yeah, that's great. I'll take it. Accurate.
here? Okay. So you kind of answered this one a little bit, but it says for reading, and then there's parentheses into things. There were a couple questions specifically on the number of teacher gamers out there.
Yeah,
Again,
I
you
kind
did
of
kind of
covered
answer
that.
this one.
Yeah.
So do you know what? It just kind of just reflecting that there was a question, and you already talked about like why you feel that connection exists. So as the proctor, I've gone into your Pearson next exact, and I've like
Incredible.
process. I know, look at this. Okay, this one, I had this question on and then I took it off and then I re-added it, but it's just an interesting question, and I don't know why I
Yeah.
have it on here. But
No, it's cool.
what's a board game you feel would be the best to universally recommend to anyone, potentially the ultimate welcoming, quote unquote, game?
That's a good question. I think a couple of answers here. I think a game that I love that I think a lot of people could be into, whether they're gamers or not, is I really love The Resistance. Avalon is specifically the Resistance version that I play. And it's like such like a very fast way to do some like bluffing, some role playing. It's very social. The other one that I've recently had incredible success playing with my students during like free time is a game called Ito. I don't know if you've played Ito, but it's like a party game where you get a number and then there's a clue category and your numbers scale from 1 to 100 and you have to give a clue that corresponds to your number. Like if the question is kind of like most important days of your life and I get like 20, then I'm thinking from 20 to 100, what is a day in my life that's actually not very important at all? But maybe it's like more important than some things, but not the vast majority of things. So you're just giving a clue. Then everyone's putting their cards down in the order we think they're in without looking at the numbers. And then we flip and see if we got it right. It's hilarious. It's really fun. It's very easy to jump into. And I think that that's one that is maybe off a lot of people's party game radar, but it has replaced almost every game that is like it for me. So it's kind of replaced Fun Facts, Green Team Wins, Wavelength. I think it's just like the perfect version of this type of game.
I think that's fair. I own that, and I technically have at least owned every other game that you mentioned in Fun Facts.
Yeah,
That's
right.
like the one that I've gotten rid of out of the group. I still do have Wavelength and Green Team
Oh,
Wins,
I do
but
too. I own all of those that I just said. Yep, no.
yep. But a funny like educationally related anecdote. We actually played Ito maybe a couple weeks ago with a couple of friends, and it honestly was like something very similar to that prompt that you just gave, is something about like rank, like important life.
Yeah, that's an actual clue
Yeah,
in Ito.
it's like important life events or whatever. So I want to say that, and I think we each had two cards. I don't know if we were playing it right to get the two cards. L nonetheless, like, but a lot of the clues that we were giving, they were education based. So it's like somebody said middle school graduation, then it was preschool
Yeah.
graduation, and then high
Yeah.
school
Actually, I have
graduation.
a question for you.
Okay.
What do you think is a more important event in your life, middle school graduation or preschool graduation?
Obviously, I have to pick one. Neither is an
Right.
acceptable.
Yeah, you have to. I want you to rank those. Which one would you say is more important if we're playing Ito?
So, in the game, my thought was middle school was higher than preschool, but I don't know. Now that I'm thinking about it.
Yeah. I think that actually, in terms of what it means in your life, I might say that preschool graduation is more important. But I say this as someone who did not attend preschool.
Okay. Well,
So
maybe that gap is just what is creating this longing for you to
maybe
experience your
I'm like imagining what could have been, right? What I missed out on. Yeah.
That is awesome. Yeah, no, I think those both games make a lot of sense. Resistance is interesting because some people don't really like the line,
I know. Yeah.
but I like that game a lot, and I think it does work well with a lot of people.
We just had to take a quick break.
Perfect. No, we have I did some more experimenting, and I've been on your test, and I've been moving things around. But basically, I've got one more. Like, we're kind of near the end, though. This hopefully was not as grueling as the ACT is,
So
and
far, it has
you
been
don't.
much more enjoyable than the four times I took the ACT.
Hopefully, this is better. But I've got one more question for reading, which is where we're on, and then we've already covered one of the science questions, and there's only going to be one more. In that category that I'm asking before the kind of like wrap-up questions, all right? But for reading into things, what connections do you see between your designing? So yeah, we mentioned crits and tricks, you're designing other things. One thing we didn't talk about too much yet was developing. You mentioned play testing and looking at rule books and helping develop a little bit. But one recent game that came out was No Loose Ends, which I got to play Shut the Books previously, but just played No Loose Ends last night, which was awesome. And then podcasting as well on the mention at the beginning of the episode, Decision Space Podcast. So it's probably a silly question because it's pretty obvious, but even through like a lot of your work within the spaces starting to exist at a relatively similar time, they start at different points. So how do you feel like they've kind of helped each other, especially based on your own personal timeline?
Yeah, just to get like, I'm still very new in all of this. So I made a New Year's resolution in 2022, I think, that I was going to design a board game. It was either 2021 or 2022. So I've only been doing this for a couple of years. And I have one game that is been crowdfunded. I have another game that was signed with a publisher, but that publisher has kind of fallen apart. So that's mine again. And then I have two more that have been signed and will come out. So that means I have designed four games that have been signed by publishers, even though people have not played them. And I just want to say that the way all these things very much are connected, right? So the reason I did development on No Loose Ends is that my friend Paul Solomon, who is also a teacher here in St. Louis, he designed the game Honey Buzz, is probably his most popular one. He also did a game called Stamp Swap with Stonemaier Games. So Paul and I are friends because I was the game that I had previously signed that is now back in my hands was going to be with Elf Creek Games. And Elf Creek, Paul used to be the developer for Elf Creek. So that's how Paul and I became friends. And he's now creative director of a new publisher called Gamehead. And he's making small box games and he was looking for small box games. And I was like, Paul, you got to make Shut the Books, mostly because I want a copy of Shut the Books, right? So he is also a fan of trick taking. And so he asked me if I wanted to help develop it. The main things he wanted is to make the theme maybe more interesting. And to make it more accessible for a broader audience, maybe for a non-trick-taking American audience. And so the only reason that I sort of felt like I could do that is because I had done a lot of play testing and I'd done some design myself. I'd sort of like studied trick-taking hardcore. It's kind of like the corner of design that I had the most familiarity with. But part of designing is play testing, and it really helps to play test other people's games and to get other people to play test your games. And so designing is one of those things that it's a lot of solitary work, but you have to have a community in the process, because just because something makes sense in your head doesn't actually mean that it's going to make sense to someone else, or other people might make decisions that you wouldn't think about making in a game. And so developing and designing are similar processes. Design is sort of the initial idea. Designing is your concept and putting together some mechanisms. But then development is sort of how do you take that idea and make it either more accessible, more balanced, more interesting. I kind of think of designing as being this creative process for you to make a game, and developing is kind of like getting it ready to be published. And you can do your own development, but I think that it is helpful to bring other people into the development process. And so I was developing Shut the Books, which is a brilliant game, which needed very little in the way of development. It was very easy. And I'm actually helping Paul. He's doing another Taiki Shinzawa game. He's doing what was originally in Japan called Segment Tricks and then re-released as Twinkle Starship, which is going to be called Trick to the Future. That'll come out next year with Gamehead, which is another trick-taking game. And so, designing and developing, I think, are very interrelated processes. I think any game developer is also doing design work. It's so funny because I think those lines are blurrier than people imagine. Like sometimes when you're playing, like for example, Brass Birmingham. Okay. Brass Birmingham was designed, its credit is, designed by Martin Wallace, right? But Martin Wallace designed Brass, the original game. Roxley took Brass and tweaked it and developed it and worked on it and made it into Brass Birmingham. And a lot of the design elements of Brass Birmingham did not come from Martin Wallace, but came from the people at Roxley. And so I think it's so funny, the line of like, when do you give someone developer credit and a co-designer credit feels mostly related to how the people were compensated as much as anything else, right? Because developers are doing design work. Now, I did very little to no loose ends. It's basically Shut the Books. But there are some games you play that changed a lot in the development process, based on how the publisher wanted it to look. My friend Taylor Reiner of Taylor's Trick Taking Table, he's a designer and he does a ton of development on trick taking games, like so much development. And he's able to do that really well because he understands design. And so I think that that's part of it. Now, podcasting being brought in, I've been lucky to, since the beginning of this year, be a co-host on the Decision Space podcast. And the main reason that that show specifically is so useful for game design is what we do on that show is analyze the decision space that a game design creates. Like it is basically a design-focused podcast. And so what I get to do on that podcast is for an hour every week, pick apart games down to like their bits and say, what is the decision space of this decision this game is asking me? So we are basically just roundtabling a discussion of design on that podcast. And so that's the other big thing that being on that podcast has helped with is that we have a pretty active Discord community. And so talking to the people there about game design, I think being able to talk about game design and talk about games is inevitably going to give you ideas for games. It's just having a community that is so actively discussing what games are asking and what decisions designers made, it's inevitably going to inspire your own ideas. So in terms of my timeline, I designed games for a little while. I should say that the way that I have given myself a schedule is that I want to design, because I don't have a ton of time for game design, one new game every year. And the reason I do that is I'm friends with Jamie Stegmeyer here in St. Louis, who runs Stonemeyer Games. And every fall, he hosts something called Stonemeyer Design Day, which is a prototype convention that people can bring game design prototypes to. And people buy tickets just to play test. And you play test other people's games, they play test your games, you give each other feedback and stuff. So my goal is that every year I need a game to bring to Design Day. And so this year will be my fourth year bringing a game to Design Day. And the previous three that I brought all ended up getting signed by publishers after Design Day. So it's always like good to, as teachers, we need deadlines. And so it's always good to have a deadline every year.
That deadline is nice. And also just in terms of success rate between the ones you've designed and gotten signed, that's pretty crazy. So
oh, bonkers. Bonkers.
That yeah. is awesome. Oh yeah. Kind of like a funny, I mean, obviously all those things coming together relatively recently, like based on your interest in being in board games is like all like newer. And as you mentioned before, some of those like delays, though, soon people will start seeing Crits and Tricks, which is awesome. And a fun confluence. Yeah, you mentioned working with Paul. I've seen, like, obviously when you went on to Decision Space, like, I saw it more. It was, like, highlighted in my radar. So I've been kind of catching up and listening to a lot of the episodes, more the recent ones. So I did, maybe, like, a week and a half ago, check out the one that you did with Paul about trick-taking games specifically. So
yeah, that one was really fun.
Yeah.
The other thing about development is, like, it's something I've now done once, and I'm working on another game for it, but these are games that like don't need a lot of development. But I'm not sure if development is something that I want to do a lot of for a game that needs a lot of development, just because it's like I could be using that energy on my own designs. And if I only have such a limited amount of time to work on game design, I selfishly would like to be making my own games. So, you know, it's a similar process, but it's also, we've talked about balancing. It's about budgeting my game time. So I like playtesting other people's games because, you know, I think the playtesting is fun. I think feedback is fun, but the actual like long work of a long development project, I think could be, for me, creatively draining to a certain extent, or at least in terms of time as a resource.
For sure. And I'm going to use that thought as a ridiculous segue. You have to use your time and thought process.
Yeah, science. This is tough.
Science. You have to concoct the most cursed blend of board game mechanisms that you feel might actually work.
So my goal is to come up with mechanisms that don't make sense together.
But do.
So here's what I'm going to do is I'm going to do an advanced search on BGG, which has a list of board game mechanisms. Mm-hmm. So, all right. What could I pull out of here? Maybe I want to make a roll and move that is also a dexterity game. Right? That's a cursed combination.
Yeah.
Right? So maybe, have you ever played Strike?
I have not played Strike.
Strike is one of my favorite. I don't know if you would even call it a dexterity game, but it's just, it's a dice throwing game where you throw dice at other dice. And then you like gain the dice if they're showing the same face at the end. So like maybe Strike, but you're playing Strike, this dexterity dice game, but your die results are used on some sort of board.
Oh,
I think could be actually kind of fun. So it's got like a push your luck dexterity element, but either maybe used in like an area control game. Oh my gosh, I want to use Strike as the combat system in an area control game. Oh there. My gosh. This game might happen. Because it feels like a combat, right? Yeah. So to use Strike as the combat mech, because I think that rolling dice for combat is just like something primal about board games. I think we all played Risk when we were kids, right? Mm-hmm. And I think now we are all frustrated by something as simple as the Risk combat system. So creating some sort of push your luck dexterity element for the combat system in area control game could be really fun.
I see it, you know.
Yeah. Let's do it.
Hey, if you need someone to develop it, I have sure. No developing experience. Let me know.
One thing that's hard, though, for something like that, like some types of games are easier because most of my playtesting happens online.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple. I'll occasionally meet up with some local designers for playtest nights. But the most active playtesting I do is with other card game designers on playingcards.io online. And so the game I'm working on for Design Day this year is a harder one to playtest like that, because the one I'm bringing to Design Day this year is a party game. And those are inherently harder to playtest online. The game I'm bringing is called Guesstimates, which is basically for sale plus my favorite things. I don't know if you've played My Favorite Things, which is a party trick-taking game.
I same deal with thought. Like I've watched, I get
Yeah,
the
for
gist
sure.
of it.
Well, okay, so the gist of My Favorite Things is that it's a party trick-taking game where you have a set of cards that are valued from like basically 1 to 0, and you, or sorry, 0 to 5. That's it. Yeah, just 1 to 0, 0 to 5. And a player will give you a category that'll say, like, ice cream flavors. And you write on the cards in a numerical order ice cream flavors you like, 1 being your favorite, the going down to 5, and then 0 is one you don't like. Then you cover up the numbers and give the cards with words to another player. And you play a trick-taking game with words that you don't know the exact values of, right? So what I'm doing is something similar. But essentially, you get a card with a value, and there's clues, and then you make a clue based on the number, kind of like Ito, actually. But then we auction off people's clues, and then you're using the clues in a bidding game for victory points based on what you think the values of the clues are.
Okay, I like
Yeah, so it's basically
that.
it's literally for sale plus Ito plus My Favorite Things. If you like put those three things in a blender, this is the exact game that comes out. But playtesting that is kind of tough because I really need at least 4, ideally more people. And you can't really do it online because you're using dry erase components and things like that. So, different forms of playtesting development are easier or harder to do.
You won't be able to chuck dice at other dice on
No, unfortunately not. So, yeah.
playingcards.io. Awesome. Well, okay, we've made it out of all of the non-optional sections of the ACT, and I am giving you another non-optional section, which is the writing, which is typically is optional.
It did not exist on the ACT when I took it.
It
I don't
did.
think. Maybe it did, and I just didn't do it. But, yeah,
Yeah,
anyway.
I think it was like probably more optional than it is now, where I think now because the test is like, well, at least like here it's free and everybody takes it on the same day or whatever. Like I don't think they like advertise that you can like opt out if you want. There's like, hey, take the writing, ACT test writing. But it's not optional because it's just my forever final two questions. If you decided to like answer these some other time during the podcast because you picked and choose, but we went in that linear order like you mentioned, things could have gotten funky. But my kind of general forever penultimate question is a text that's been on your mind. It could be a board game, video game, book, movie, show, song, poem, podcast, or whatever.
Okay, so a style of video game that I've been going down the rabbit hole and getting obsessed with are shmups.
Ooh, nice.
I don't know if you, so this shmup
Oh
is
yeah,
short
I
for
know.
shoot 'em up, and a lot of these are you're like a spaceship or something that's just like firing off a million bullets while also dodging bullets. I've gone really down the rabbit hole in these games. I've got like I bought like a little like retro handheld thing that plays emulated games on it. I've just been burning through them. I'm terrible at them, but they're so addictive, right? And that's kind of similar to like I also really like beat 'em up games as well. And so this is kind of checking a kind of similar box for me. So yeah, I've been playing a lot of shmup video games. That's on my mind. That's what I'm kind of playing, laying in bed. So
Okay.
yeah.
Is there like, I know you said a lot of them are older emulated ones. Is there one that I guess has stuck out the most just for the sake of like a title? Like this is.
There's an old arcade game that's one of like the big early shmups called Donpachi, or maybe Dodonpachi. That's the one that I've been really just grinding through like crazy. The other thing that's been on my mind a lot is I've been obsessed with UFO 50, like,
Okay.
and a podcast that goes with it, right? So there's
Yeah.
a video game podcast called Eggplant. And Eggplant is a podcast of board game de or sorry, video game developers interviewing other video game developers. But this past year, they've been doing a UFO 50 book club where every week they all play one UFO 50 game and then do a whole episode deep diving that one game in chronological order with the game. And they just did their last game, and I've been listening to it all year. So I've been on this journey with them the whole year, playing and listening to stuff about UFO 50. And so I've been obsessed with that game for a year now, and it feels so, it's on my mind because that podcast is now over. And that's been weekly listening for an entire year, the year of UFO 50. And so I'm just so in awe of that game. And it's been really cool to have this deep dive podcast digging into each of those individual games.
I feel like at this point, UFO 50 has probably been the most mentioned game on this podcast in
Oh,
terms of
really?
video games.
Yeah.
And I was going to say that and like bring it up because you mentioned shmups and there's like three or four
There
on
sure
at
are.
least. I
Yep.
forgot the exact number,
And actually, it
but
was listening to them talk about the shmup games on that podcast that inspired me to seek out the genre. So UFO 50 is the patient zero of my current shmup obsession.
That's hilarious. Yeah, I my just kind of like reading my video game playing has been down a lot too, but I've probably put in pushing 35 hours on that game total, which is it's a good number, like
Yeah.
for me, like that's a good chunk,
Agreed.
but I don't even think I've opened up every cartridge in that
Not all
game
of
yet.
them are my type of game,
Yeah.
right? Some of them really are, though.
Awesome. Okay, you've mentioned a few things. I'll see if I can kind of like you mentioned development-wise that Trick to the Future is going to be another game coming out from Gamehead. We've talked about Crits and Tricks a bit. You also brought up guesstimates as well, but obviously just kind of things that you're working on. Is there anything else that you can like mention for people to look out
What's
for
really
from you?
funny is if we were recording this podcast 1 month later, I have a title coming out next month that is unannounced. So there will be a game of mine coming out next month that people will hear about. And then, yeah, another ladder climbing game that I got signed that will be coming out at some point in the future. So those are the projects that people will definitely see. And then I also just recommend the Decision Space podcast. Just to what's coming up on that, I'm about to start a series on deck building because deck building is a mechanism that I really love. And so we're about to do an episode that's like deck building 101 that's going to mostly be about Dominion and then kind of dig into how that's inspired other board games and video games. So look out for that if you like deck building. I'm going to do a series of episodes on that.
That's fantastic. I mean, yeah, with that extra exposure and hearing more and more about the podcast and, kind of especially just because I saw that you had joined the team, I've been catching up and now it's like there's so much content, like,
Oh my
and by
gosh.
content I mean like, like in a very positive, like there's so much stuff to chew and dig into there, and I've been listening to more and more, but it's been like a nice journey for me checking that out for sure.
Thank you for listening. Yeah, it's fun. It's as you know, it can be a lot of work, right? Because I'm now editing the show as well, which means I'm basically dedicating 2 nights of my week to this show because I record one night and then I edit one night. So it's a big commitment.
Yeah,
Because we
that is
do
a
a weekly
lot.
show, which is nuts.
Yeah, I don't even know what my schedule is. At one point, it was like bi-weekly, but that's also coordinating different schedules, so it's a funky thing. Awesome. Okay, you technically have a new final question though. Extra credit
Yeah.
on ACT. Is there ever extra credit? Now there is. How much coffee do you drink on a daily basis?
So I am chemically dependent on it, right? It also is a performance-enhancing drug for the profession of teaching, right? But I just need a little bit. So we have like one of those Nespresso pod machines, my wife and I. And so I drink a double espresso pod every day. And then throughout the day, I'm sipping on tea. But if I ever forget or like for whatever, it's happened before. Just the world is numb to me. So I think that coffee doesn't make me feel good. It just makes me not feel bad. Right? It's just normal functioning capacity. So yeah, just like a double espresso pod. In the summer, I drink cold brew just because if I'm not at school, then I can, be more free with how much caffeine I take in. If I drink cold brew during the school day, I'd probably be insane. So tea gives me the nice, even caffeine spread throughout the day. So yes, just a double espresso and then some tea.
I mean, 18 years into the profession, it feels like you have struck a perfect balance with your caffeine intake.
Thank you. Thank you. Are you a big coffee drinker?
Yes, my coffee consumption, like schedule and habits have gone all over the place. Like when I was first teaching, I was drinking way less than I drink now, but I was also drinking way more than I had previously. So it wasn't working well with my body. And I don't know. But now I'm also running a lot more than I had then, which could seem counterintuitive to drink so much coffee, but I feel like I've got it pretty good for me where I like the more I drink coffee, the more water I drink then too. So yeah, I've been smart about drinking, 40 plus ounces of coffee a day. It's cool.
That's great. You know, drugs or whatever, you know, use them responsibly, kids.
Yeah, I was gonna say, don't take advice from me. Well, thank you so much. I will probably be pouring myself the next coffee very soon, but I really appreciate you taking one of the balls. It may have been like the orange or the purple one, and separating a little bit of that board game time for with
Yes.
me here. So.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Intertextual Experience, the most
Standardized test ready.
podcast about board games and any other text that they connect to. Thank you so much for spending your time here. Your support through listening to this podcast means everything to the show's success. If you enjoyed the project, consider giving us a rating or review and sharing it with any other people in your life you would feel would like it as well. Any further support, such as sending an email to say hey, following some of the show's social media accounts, or contributing any monetary support to help pay for some necessary subscriptions would be greatly appreciated. All of that information can be found in the show notes. Until next time, keep playing, watching, reading, listening, experiencing.